Welcome to Torah Timecha Parsha with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Liat Meyerfeld, and this week is Parashat Emor. Rule number one in public speaking, don't tell your audience you're still figuring things out. Rule number two, definitely don't open by saying, I'm not sure this is going to make you feel any better. Rule number three, if you're going to break the first two rules, at least do it with confidence. And yet, that's exactly where I find myself with this topic. Because the Psukim and Parshat Emor about a Kohen with a mum, a blemish, about who serves and who doesn't, are not simple. They're not neat. They can make us uncomfortable. But the difficulty is not in the Torah. The Torah is MS, complete, coherent, and true. The complexity is in us, in how we hear it, how we read it, and how limited our categories can be when we try to make sense of it. I've spent time with the sources, with the Mefarshim, and will offer a few different approaches. We might not end up with a fully satisfying answer for everyone. But maybe Torah questions aren't meant to behave like equations. Maybe they're more like music. At first you hear separate notes. Some feel wrong, some feel out of place, some feel unresolved. But over time, if you keep listening, something happens. You begin to hear structure and feel rhythm. And nothing changed in the Torah. What changed was us. We're learning how to listen differently. Parshas Emor returns us to the Kohanim. Because if Parshas Kedoshim called on all of us to live lives of holiness, to bring Kedusha into the fabric of everyday life, then Emor asks a different question. What does holiness look like at its most concentrated point? What does it look like when it's not diffused through life, but focused, intensified, and embodied in those who stand closest to the Mikdash? And so the Torah returns to the Kohen, to the one who lives at that point of contact. But by now, the ear has changed. What once might have sounded like technical rules begins to sound differently. The question is no longer just how the service is performed, but what kind of person can become part of that performance. The focus shifts from action to alignment, from the music being played to the instrument itself. And after everything that has unfolded, the Kohen is no longer just a participant in the system, but a living expression of it. And the Torah begins to ask not only what is done in the Mikdash, but who is able to carry its harmony without distorting its sound. At the center of the Parsha are guidelines that stir up so many emotions. A Kohen with a mum, a blemish, does not serve in the Beit HaMikdash. Examples of defects is a Kohen who is blind or lame or hunchback. Whoa! At first reading, it sounds like a statement about value, about worth, about who belongs and who doesn't belong in sacred spaces. And to many ears today, shaped by a modern instinct towards total inclusivity, this can feel deeply uncomfortable. We need to take a step back and ask, what's actually happening here? The Torah is not speaking through a lens of judgment. The Torah is speaking about alignment and function within a system. The Beit HaMikdash is not general human space. It's a structured service. Think of an orchestra. The question is not, is this instrument valuable? Of course it is. The question is, does it belong in this movement of the composition? Is it aligned with the role this moment requires? And that reframes everything. Because the Kohen is not being evaluated as a person. He's being positioned within a system of harmony. And it's important to add two points. First, this is not a measure of the Kohen's spiritual level. There are many deeply holy people who cannot perform this service. Even Moshe Rabbeinu himself was excluded from certain roles. So this is not about who is greater or closer to Hashem. Second, this is not a total disqualification of the Kohen. A Kohen with these physical conditions does not lose his identity. He remains fully a Kohen and continues to serve in many essential ways, teaching Torah, guiding halachic life, and being part of the spiritual leadership of the people. His contribution remains intact. The limitation is only here, within the structured service of the Mikdash itself. Because in this particular moment, within this particular system, something very specific is required, and that is where the Torah draws the boundary. Here is where the first principle becomes clear. Point number one, how we represent ourselves to Hashem. With respect, with wholeness, with awe. The Kohen is not just an individual acting inside the Mikdash. He's a representative. He stands on behalf of the Jewish people before Hashem. He's the face of our approach. And in that role, the Torah places a condition. A Kohen with a mum cannot serve in the Beit HaMikdash. Rav Samson of Hirsch deepens this point in a very striking way. He explains that the Beit HaMikdash is not meant to be a place that draws people in because they're broken. It's not meant to function like a refuge for collapse or desperation, like a spiritual hospital where only the wounded come for repair. Judaism, he says, certainly does hold and heal the broken. That's true, of course. But that's not what the Mikdash represents at its core. Because Hashem didn't give us Torah to merely survive life. He gave us Torah to elevate life, to sanctify life in its fullness. So the Mikdash is not primarily a place of spiritual emergency. In Rav Hirsch's words, it is life in its completeness, in its freshness and strength, that is consecrated there before Hashem. Not brokenness, not collapse, not spiritual depletion, but vitality, presence, wholeness. And that is why the Kohen must embody that state, because he's not only performing service, he's representing the very posture from which we approach Hashem. And within the system of Korban, it begins to make sense. The Korban itself must be whole and without blemish, not because Hashem needs perfection, but because an offering represents something larger than itself. It represents the ideal of what we bring to our relationship with Hashem. We bring a desire to fully connect, to be completely present, and the Kohen, as the one bringing that offering, becomes part of that same language. He's not just performing an act, he's embodying representation, and in that space, wholeness matters. The Kohen doesn't only represent us to Hashem, he also represents Hashem to us. And now we enter a very different world, the world of human perception. The Kohanim today still have the privilege of blessing the people, and there's a Mishnah that teaches that a Kohen with visible blemishes does not get up to bless the people. Why? Because people will look at him, not because he's less worthy, but because attention is drawn to what is visible. Already the focus shifts, not the Kohen himself, but the gaze of the community. And then the Gemara sharpens the point. Rabbi Yochanan teaches that even a Kohen blind in one eye should not bless the people. Yet the Gemara records a case where such a Kohen did duchen. Its answer is striking. He was familiar in his city. Nothing about him changed, only perception changed. At first, difference dominates vision, but familiarity reorganizes what we see. The person becomes primary, not the feature. Halacha then codifies this principle. A visible moon disqualifies only when it draws attention. But if the Kohen is known in the community, he may still bless the congregation. So the halacha is already pointing to something subtle. The issue is not the Kohen, it's the instability of human attention. And that brings us back to the Mikdash, because in that space, attention is meant to be directed entirely towards Hashem, towards the unity, perfection, and undivided presence of Hashem. And human perception is fragile. It gets pulled towards whatever stands out visually. So the Torah sets a condition. The Kohen must not introduce visual fragmentation into that space. Not because Hashem is affected by appearance, but because we are. And therefore, the Kohen in the Mikdash is required to embody wholeness as a safeguard for the clarity of the encounter. The Kli Yakar proposes an entirely different understanding. A mum, he suggests, is not only physical. It can be the outer expression of an inner spiritual reality. He says that in ancient times, there were people who read the human body almost like a moral map. So they understood that a person's inner life does not remain hidden. It emerges outward. It becomes visible over time, and they could see it. For example, someone whose moral vision is distorted, someone who lives with corruption, like taking bribes, may eventually experience that expressed in blindness, not as punishment, but as correspondence, inner vision shaping outer vision. And someone who carries arrogance, a kind of inflated posture of self, may eventually find that expressed in instability or injury to the legs, because the way a person walks through the world internally can shape the way they literally walk. The body in this sense becomes a language, a visible unfolding of the inner self. And these ancient wise people, they go even further. They suggest that sometimes even a future mum can already be sensed now, because a person's actions are already setting a trajectory in motion, a direction of becoming. So when the Torah says, Asher yiyeh bo mum, a man who will have a blemish in him, it's not only speaking about what is present. In him points to what is already unfolding internally. And underneath it all is a deeper claim. Human beings are integrated. The inner world does not remain inner. It becomes visible. Any inner distortion will eventually find expression externally, like music becoming sound. A little girl was once found prancing in front of a mirror, singing about how beautiful she was. Her mother, aware of the dangers of self-definition based on externals, taught her young daughter, "As long as you do mitzvos, you will always be beautiful. And the more mitzvos you do, the more beautiful you will be." The inner finds expression externally. So a mum is not only a physical disqualification, it's the outer edge of an inner reality that is already forming. Because for the Kohen standing in the Mikdash in the most sacred space, what matters is not only appearance, but whether inner and outer being are in a state of integrity and wholeness. There is a midrash that hits this idea in a more visceral way, a haunting example of inner worlds forming outer realities. It transpires Al Ne'arot Bavel, by the rivers of Babylon. After the destruction of the first temple and the exile, Nebuchadnezzar wanted to further degrade the Jewish people, and he commands the Levim to sing and play musical instruments for him and his gods. How can we sing the song of Hashem in a foreign land? Ech nashir et shir Hashem al admat nechal? They refuse. They refuse to sing in praise of the Babylonian idols. In profound despair, they cut off their thumbs so that they would not be able to play instruments in honor of those gods. On the surface, an act of mourning, heroism, loyalty, refusal. But there's another layer underneath. According to the Kliyakar's approach, we understand that the outer act is reflecting an inner state. Something in that moment of exile had broken their sense of future. A hidden lack of emuna had entered, that they no longer truly believed that they would return, that they would once again stand in the mikdash and play those instruments. So the physical blemish they created was not just damage to the body. It was the external expression of an inner fracture in hope. At first glance, it looked like grief, but it was actually a representation of lack of emuna. The Hasidic master, the Bat Ayin, based on the Berditcha Rav, also maintains that a Kohen must be whole, without any spiritual deficiencies. Mum, he notices, is the Gematria 86, the same as Elohim, Hashem's trait of judgment. If there would be a Kohen who has within him only judgment, he is unfit for service. Only a Kohen who also embodies Chesed can serve, recognizing Hashem's Chesed to his creations and himself feeling compassion and doing kindness for the nation. A Kohen must be spiritually expansive and whole to serve. The Kohen's Mikdash service belongs only to those in whom there is alignment, where the inner world and the outer expression are in harmony, and what a Kohen carries within is reflected truthfully and whole in the way they present themselves. Rabbi Jonathan Sachs explains the Kohen's need to be without blemish as part of the greater framework of the Mikdash. The Mishkan and later the Beit HaMikdash represent something unique in religious life, a point of contact between the infinite and the finite, between Hashem, who is beyond time and space, and us, human beings, who exist entirely within time and space. The Mikdash is described as the kissing point of heaven and earth. That meeting point is not simple, and in Rabbi Sachs' language, can be dangerous. Because when eternity enters temporality, when the infinite enters physical space, there's a kind of metaphysical instability. The categories don't easily coexist, because infinity does not naturally fit inside limitation. And therefore, the Mikdash is constructed as a highly controlled environment. Everything is measured, defined, structured, limited. Not because physicality is bad, but because unbound physicality would overwhelm the encounter. And within that structure, the Kohen becomes part of the architecture of transcendence. This is why, Rav Sachs suggests, there is a deliberate stripping away of raw human individuality in the service. The Mikdash is a place where individuality is reconfigured into system. The Kohen is not there as himself in the ordinary sense. He's there as a function within a sacred system. The Kohen becomes part of a choreography, not erased, but repositioned. His body, his movement, even his appearance are drawn into symbolic alignment, not because he is less human, but because the space demands a different mode of being human, a filtered, structured, almost angelic presentation. In greater society, human difference is celebrated, but this space is not meant to reflect ordinary human life. It's meant to suspend it. And that is why the contrast is so striking. Because the very same Kohen outside that moment returns to full human reality, to individuality, to difference, to asymmetry, to personal identity, lived humanity. Inside the Mikdash, he's almost abstracted. Human beings struggle when too much immediate reality floods perception. We narrow, we reduce, we filter. And part of what structured systems like the Mikdash do is actually the opposite. They control what is seen so that meaning can be carried without distortion. But outside that system, the work becomes ours, to learn how to not collapse a person into the most visible thing about them. Holiness is not the erasure of the physical world. It's the careful structuring of it so that the encounter with transcendence does not collapse under the weight of immediacy. Now we are left with multiple frameworks. A mum can be understood in a few ways. It can be something that doesn't fit within the world of Kedusha. It can reflect something about the person's inner spiritual state. It can affect how we perceive the Avodah, or it can be a category the Torah uses within the Mikdash. So the question is not simply what is a mum, but where does it exist? In the body, in the soul, in the system, or in the way it is seen? And Chazal are quietly moving us towards something deeper. That which we are looking at cannot be reduced to a single layer, like music, where we're trained to hear multiple layers at once without collapsing them into one. At first, separation, dissonance, interruption. But over time, we begin to hear pattern, we begin to hear structure, we begin to hear rhythm. And nothing changed in the music. What changed was us. Our capacity to hear expanded with time through familiarity, relationship, and depth. We begin to see more than what first met the eye. So maybe holiness is not the absence of difference and not the removal of tension. Maybe it's the ability to hold multiple tones without collapsing them into sameness, to allow structure and individuality to coexist, to see a human being not as a static image, but as part of a larger unfolding composition. And perhaps the deepest avoda is not only to stand before Hashem, but to learn how to see another person and even ourselves and begin to hear the deeper music beneath what first felt like interruption. To step into that rhythm until what once felt like fragmentation can be lived as a dance of wholeness.